enough to lower the orbit so that it will impact. Now, this is by ground command. Just one command will start the engine, and then another command will be sent up to stop the engine at the desired time.
Would a secondary mission be to clear the lunar orbit of extra vehicles?
This is really the primary objective, and I'm sorry I didn't mention that before. The reason that we're deorbiting and impacting it is not for the science, although that is a nice benefit. But it's really to clear the moon of orbital debris, as we call it, things that have been used up and are no longer useful to us. We like to get them out of lunar orbit where they might interfere with future lunar missions.
One of the other missions to be accomplished is a photographic mission in lunar orbit for future landing sites, I assume.
That's right. It's called bootstrap photography, and that term is very appropriate in as much as we're up there to conduct a landing mission and do the science for this mission. However, by staying one additional day in orbit, we're able to take pictures of future landing sites and thereby increase our data supply of information on these sites for future landings. And as we heard earlier in an interview with Dick Gordon about this, these photographs are very, very important to the following crews, telling them just what they can expect to see and how things will look as they're approaching their landing site. It also provides the information for making three-dimensional models of the site. And these are very important also in simulations.
We're now 143 hours and 39 minutes into the mission of Apollo 12. We'll return with our continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12, but now let's go to the Voice of America newsroom for... Let's go to Rhett Turner in Houston for a late status report.
Quick status report on the spacecraft and then that news, I believe. Let's see. The spacecraft are 48 minutes until loss of signal again. They're continuing to swing around the front side of the moon. Pete Conrad has made a visual sighting on Yankee Clipper above him, and Al Bean is now in the cockpit with Pete going through procedures preparing for the next maneuver, terminal phase initiation, which will come, in fact, just a few moments from now. We'll report more to you later from Houston on the progress of Conrad and Bean in Intrepid.
And now to the Voice of America newsroom for a late summary of news.
America's Apollo 12 astronauts, Commanders Conrad and Bean, successfully passed another critical moment in their mission when they blasted off the moon's ocean of storms for a link up with their command ship and the long voyage home. Charles Conrad and Alan Bean left the lunar surface a little over an hour and a half ago and immediately began preparations for the delicate and complex series of maneuvers that will bring them together with their colleague Richard Gordon in the main spacecraft. Conrad, who perhaps has been the most exuberant of the astronauts, called out, "Away we go," as the lunar module's ascent engine ignited. A few minutes later, they were in orbit of the moon and readying themselves for rendezvous. At the Vietnam talks in Paris, American Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge called once more for serious negotiations to end the war. He noted that the United States has proposed a mutual withdrawal of all outside forces from South Vietnam within 1 year, and he said the United States would be prepared to consider any proposal for a mutual withdrawal even sooner to end the Vietnamese conflict. The communist side insisted once more on a unilateral withdrawal of U.S. troops and dissolution of the Saigon government. There was no major combat reported in South Vietnam today, but enemy gunners continued shelling Allied positions in the Bu Prang area of the Central Highlands near the Cambodian border. The stepped-up fighting last week was reflected in the highest casualty figures for both sides in about 2 months. The United States and the Soviet Union held their second working session of the Strategic Arms Limitation talks in Helsinki, this time at the Soviet Embassy. It was announced only that the negotiators will meet again next Monday at the American Embassy. The closed Helsinki meetings are described as preliminary and exploratory, with each nation seeking a basis for future substantive talks. Radio Vienna reports that two men, presumably of Polish nationality, hijacked a Polish airliner with 18 persons aboard and forced the pilot to land the plane in the Austrian capital. The broadcast said the hijackers used a toy pistol and two fake bombs to commandeer the plane. They are being questioned by Vienna police. The airliner, according to the broadcast, was on a scheduled flight from Warsaw to the Czechoslovak city of Bratislava, just across the river Danube from Vienna. Our correspondent in Athens says the governments of Greece and Cyprus have called for continuation of the intercommunal talks on the island of Cyprus. A joint communique issued at the end of a visit to Athens by the Cypriot Foreign Minister, Spiros Kyprianou, says every effort should be made to maintain peace on the island. A Nigerian airliner crashed and burned with the loss of all passengers and crew as it prepared to land at Lagos on a flight from London. Correspondent Fred Brown reports from Lagos that the plane carried 75 passengers and a crew of 10. News dispatches from London identified the plane as a VC-10 and reported that the passengers were mostly Nigerian Airlines personnel returning to Lagos. French Foreign Minister Maurice Schumann has arrived in Tunisia for a three-day official visit at the invitation of Foreign Minister Habib Bourguiba, Jr. Mr. Bourguiba held official talks in Paris earlier this year. The two officials are to discuss closer relations in the political and economic fields. Three Israeli civilians were reported wounded when their car was ambushed and attacked by Arab guerrillas near the village of Jabalia in the occupied Gaza Strip. Egyptian and Israeli forces again engaged in heavy artillery exchanges across the southern sector of the Suez Canal. And Jordan says its forces exchanged artillery fire with Israeli troops near the King Hussein Bridge and earlier prevented an Israeli patrol from crossing the Jordan River to the east bank. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade has urged its members to begin preparations for a new round of tariff cuts and trade liberalization moves. Director Oliver Long said the trade group has produced a high degree of order and stability in trade relations, and that trade between nations increased 121% in the decade beginning in 1958. The free market price of gold fell below $37, the lowest in almost 2 years, as selling increased in London, Zurich, and Paris. New confidence in European currencies is given as the reason. British Defense Secretary Dennis Healey says Catholic and Protestant extremists will be excluded from joining the new Ulster Police Force being formed to replace Northern Ireland's Protestant-dominated Special Reserve Police. The new force will not be used for riot duties in urban areas. The commander of the Soviet Missile Forces, Marshal Nikolai Krylov, says that its weapons can hit any part of the world, quickly and accurately. He made the statement in an interview marking Soviet Missile Forces Day. President Nixon's Director of Communications, Herbert Klein, told a New York meeting of radio and television executives that the administration has no intention of interfering with news presentation. He said Vice President Spiro Agnew recently raised the question of journalistic objectivity because the general public questions the credibility of the news media. Congress has approved a major change in the draft law. It will permit the administration to set up a lottery system next year. And Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird says the plan is to draft only 19-year-olds in another year. Friday's vote on the confirmation of Judge Clement Haynsworth to the Supreme Court is expected to be close. Two leading Republicans announced Wednesday they will split their votes, with Senator George Aiken of Vermont in favor and Senator John Williams of Delaware opposed. An airliner with 14 persons aboard crashed into a mountainside during a rainstorm near Glen Falls, New York, on a flight from Albany. First reports said there were no survivors. A funeral mass scheduled today for Joseph P. Kennedy, the 81-year-old father of an American president and two senators, will be celebrated by Richard Cardinal Cushing at a small Roman Catholic church in Hyannisport, Massachusetts. The National Broadcasting Company says it has learned that the Health, Education, and Welfare Department will announce that foods containing cyclamates will be allowed to continue on sale, with a warning label that they should be consumed only upon the advice of a physician. That's the news. This is Leo Scully reporting on The Voice of America.
And this is The Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. And now some highlights of the flight of Apollo 12 to this moment. The second EVA, the extravehicular activity, began nearly 2 hours earlier than scheduled. Both men were eager to go to complete their second major objective, disconnect sections of the Surveyor spacecraft, which had soft-landed on the moon some 2.5 years ago, and bring them back to Earth. On their short trip of some few hundred meters between the lunar module and the Surveyor craft, Conrad and Bean continued their collection of spectacular-looking moon rocks. VOA's Rhett Turner narrated their progress from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
We're listening to Al and Pete on the surface of the moon.
And some of the other rocks that seem to be resting in a hole, I'm putting them all in a...
That's Al Bean.
One here,
He's putting some rocks in
sample
bag one.
Some of the others don't have any coating on them at all. I'm picking them up with the tongs. I can't tell how strong they are, but they don't seem to hold together too well. They seem kind of weak. There you go. I'll head on over where Pete is.
He says...
Roger, we copy that. If you're going to document that, try to get some of the material around the glass as well as the glass itself.
Some of these crystal-like rocks with glass in them, some of them seem to be weak, Al says.
I want to get over and start working with Pete as a team here.
Roger.
Just didn't want to have to try to remember where that was.
They are separated a couple hundred meters, I believe, here now. Al is back near that solar wind window shade type device. He took some more pictures of it and described how it was mounted on the pole there. And then he is to join Pete near the head crater, as it's called, the head of the figurative snowman, and work as a team. He's used his tongs.
I've been concentrating, Houston, as I came walking over here to head crater to see if there were any... possible changes in either texture, slope, color, anything you can think of or anything that I could think of that would say to me that I was walking on a different surface than I was when I started. And I haven't seen a thing yet. It all looks the same. It all looks like it's covered with this black rock.
While busily collecting lunar rock samples, the two Apollo astronauts documented their findings with still photographs and a running commentary to Apollo Control in Houston. Finally, the two men reached the vicinity of the Surveyor spacecraft, the object of their walk.
So I think we'd go right up the other rim and around to...
Sure.
Right on
that big blocky baby there.
Right over there. That neat crater.
Yeah.
Well, I'd rock you. Just go up
the back of the limb.
They're approaching. They have entered the crater on the south rim, have worked down inside this large crater, which is some 200 meters wide. They are working from the south edge down around inside, around to the east quadrant, and that's where the Surveyor is located, just down inside, 20, 30, 40 meters down inside from the east edge. And they're working toward it now.
Let me take some pictures up here around it.
When Bean and Conrad did get to the Surveyor, they found that in the almost 3 years of exposure to the direct rays of the sun, it had changed its color, having been baked to deep brown. As they began to recover portions of the surveyor for examination later on Earth, VOA's anchor team described the process.
Throughout this second EVA, we have had very excellent voice communications from the two astronauts as they walked about the lunar surface. They ranged as much as, some 300 meters away from the Intrepid, the landing craft. John Hammersmith of NASA, who has been with us throughout this broadcast, what are your impressions on this second EVA? The astronauts made their way down the side of this crater without any problem.
Yes, as Rat noted, after I'd commented about all the precautions that we were prepared to take, the conditions there were obviously much much milder than we had anticipated as a normal situation. Of course, they were prepared for a situation more severe in terms of their ability to get around. It sounds like it has been very successful, and the geologists should be very happy with all the material it's brought back because it has been documented so well. This was one of the problems, if you will, of the first manned lunar landing, that they didn't have time to do all the things that they wanted to do, and they sort of had to pick up material and run with it rather than being able to really document exactly what they were picking up and just how they were doing it and where it lay and all this sort of thing. On this trip, they've obviously had plenty of time to pick their specimens very carefully and to very carefully and document exactly what was happening. It seems like, in some ways, as we listen to them, that they were doing it for our benefit, but that is for the general audience. But really what our listeners have been hearing is some meticulous scientific observations and data gathering in process.
Well, really, this is the beginning of lunar exploration. As you say, Apollo 11 was to get there safely and return with some of the scientific findings as bonus.
That's right. That fulfilled the focusing objective of the Apollo program, which was to get them in there and return them.
Well, let's get back to the lunar surface via the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, back to Pete Conrad and Alan Bean, who are still down in that crater next to the surveyor. Let's go to correspondent Rhett Turner at Houston.
The astronauts have unstowed the cutters, the cutting mechanism, and are now cutting off some of the tubular material around the camera on the surveyor craft. This camera is to be brought back as one of the primary pieces of material to be returned to Earth. Let's listen to Al and Pete.
It is a Y cable, but it's in a different manner. Not gonna... Okay. You're gonna have nails they didn't tell us either. Look at that. Two extra ones. Yeah. I'll tell you what, you're just gonna have to get that... I'm gonna have to cut it on the other side. Just wait a second, let me get in there. Okay.
Pete says there are a few more cables than they told us about. Cutting cables and support structure.
I got to cut the cable back here, though. Okay. Why don't you give that a cut right there, Pete? All right.
Pete apparently has the cutters, and Al Bean is holding on to the mechanism that's to be returned.
No, it goes around the camera. All right. Oh, no, it doesn't either. On those tubes, isn't it? It is. It's wired entirely.
No, you got to cut the other side of that little hole.
Yeah, I know.
There you go.
Now you got it. And
there are several metal tubes which are part of the spacecraft structure itself, which on which is mounted the TV camera.
Hey, that cut's easy.
These tubes and wiring going to the camera are being clipped. Then the astronauts will be able to remove the camera from the surveyor spacecraft.
Let me get in there close. Okay, we got the...
The surveyor bag is a bag which is mounted on the back of Pete Conrad's portable life support system.
Tube. Okay, that's in there. Good. Let me make sure that's in there tight, Pete.
And this camera is being placed in the bag.
You're listening to recorded highlights of the second EVA of the Apollo 12 mission. Their mission completed, the two astronauts slowly returned to the Intrepid, repressurized their craft, and climbed aboard for another period of rest and food before liftoff time prior to their rendezvous with the command module some 6.5 hours later. Here is what it sounded like beginning 20 seconds before that liftoff.
20 seconds.
Looking good, Pete.
Okay.
10 seconds.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, lift off. And away we go. Did it fire? Joint?
Looking good.
Intrepid Houston, copy ignition. Guidance looks good.
316 feet above the lunar surface.
Boy, you sure can make it quiet. Well, I don't know what. 5, 30 seconds, 177.
1,594 feet above the lunar...
That's pretty good. We're on our way.
And so the lunar module went into orbit around the moon in preparation for its docking with Yankee Clipper, scheduled for shortly after 18 hours GMT. And now let's go to Houston and Rhett Turner for a late status report.
Astronauts Conrad and Bean are now preparing, apparently, to go ahead with a slight CDH, constant delta height maneuver.
Less than a minute away now.
Dick Gordon can see them on this with the sextant, one of the optical instruments on his Yankee Clipper spacecraft. They are right over the takeoff point, right over the landing site. Dick said something about the limb. We'll hear in about 27 seconds whether this very slight firing is accomplished.
Let me know if I can help you.
Let me know if I can help you, says Gordon. This is to take a little of the wobble out of that circular orbit. 10 seconds till ignition. Very, very small.
Do you want to count down?
3 seconds. Should accomplish that right now. The delta velocity is nominally zero, meaning very small. Pete and Al in Intrepid are not radioing to us. They're busy at it.
Guidance says they're burning now.
This would be a fairly small maneuver.
Okay, Pete.
That's Dick Gordon, says okay, Pete. He's
watched. Burn is concluded.
Houston.
Roger, Pete. Looks good.
We'll wait for a report from Conrad. This ought to put them right in the position for TPI, or terminal phase initiation, to come at 144 hours, 36 minutes, just 35 minutes from now. That's the maneuver which starts them up toward Yankee Clipper in orbit 30 kilometers above them. Pete and Al will come in any moment here now with a report on the burn. They're looking at their primary guidance navigation system, the gyroscope-driven platform. They're calling information from the computer on the residuals from the burn, as it's called, and when they have all of this jotted down, they will confirm back with mission control. Of course, the tracking station in Madrid is now primary right now, feeding tracking information back to Earth. They also will have tracking data to confirm what is read on board. An okay coming down from the moon from Pete Conrad and Al Bean. Minutes until the two spacecraft again go behind the moon out of touch with the Earth. Mission control, Pete Frank is the man in the chief flight director's seat at the moment. the guidance officers and the flight dynamics officers in the trench, the front row of the consoles here, now waiting for computers in the back rooms and downstairs to refine tracking data to see how the tracking stations on Earth agree or disagree with the onboard computation from Pete Conrad's onboard guidance and navigation system. Dr. Charles Berry, the chief flight surgeon, is watching.
ITPI time was 1443454 5487. That's pretty good.
That sounded like Dick Gordon with a projection of TPI time.
1443454 5487.
That's Dick Gordon, apparently, with his calculation on when the terminal phase initiation should come. All of the astronauts doing their own calculations on board in case they are ever out of touch with Earth. This is another one of the things on which experience needs to be gained for future longer-range flights when the astronauts will be completely out of touch with Earth.
1443454 5487.
I think that was Al Bean there. They're projecting ahead again. The name of the game now is to look ahead on what is next. In guidance and navigation of spacecraft, constantly looking ahead, projecting when the terminal phase initiation will begin. Now, all of these figures change every time there is a rocket burn, a rocket firing, because then the flight path is slightly different, so they must be refined from navigation. New navigation figures must be figured out. Bill Land, you care to comment on this procedure?
Well, the procedure they just went through to tweak up the orbit and get it such that it's a constant difference in height between the two vehicles, and depending upon the calculations they come up with as a result of this burn and in a comparison with the ground calculations, they will then conduct their terminal phase initiate maneuver, and that's normally about 12 noon Eastern Standard Time, be about another 33 minutes, but they're refining that information and they'll come up with a precise time. That maneuver will then allow them to catch up and join the orbit of the command service module.
We're hearing very little from them. I thought we would have a report on the burn status. Instead, they went right ahead and projected toward TPI, terminal
Apollo
phase.
Control Houston at 144 hours, 5 minutes now into the flight. We presently show Intrepid and Yankee Clipper some 80 nautical miles apart.
About 150 kilometers apart, in direct line of sight. The Intrepid is about 30 kilometers below Yankee Clipper in a slightly lower orbit.
Bill Land, what contributions is Pete Conrad, not Pete Conrad, but Gordon making in the command module to these maneuvers?
Well, all he can do at this moment is keep track of when the maneuvers are to occur and just what direction and what change in velocity should be made for each of the maneuvers. And then he has himself set up to do an opposite type of maneuver in the event that rescue is required, in the event that the LEM, the lunar module, is unable to perform one of the small burns. However, everything has been going so well so far, and there doesn't seem to be any problem with the reaction control system or the attitude control system of the lunar module. So I would expect that while he's prepared to do these things, it looks like everything will go nominally, and the lunar module will conduct the rendezvous as the active unit.
During the next 20 minutes that we are in contact with both spacecraft, the gigantic tracking computers on Earth will refine their orbital parameters and possibly give them a recommendation of just when and how this terminal phase burn should occur around behind the moon. And then the astronauts on board the spacecraft, Intrepid, they have a choice of using their own computations on board, which Pete would like to do if he can each time, just to gain confidence in the independence of the onboard calculations. They also can listen to the recommendation of the calculations Dick Gordon is making in Yankee Clipper overhead, and all of them get a good exercise. In fact, that's what they're doing right now, is we don't hear anything from them. They're working on their computations on just where they are relative to each other. 20 more minutes until they do pass behind the moon, and then this TPI rocket maneuver will be at 144 hours, 34 minutes, 54 seconds, according to Pete Conrad and Al Bean's computations. This is 2 minutes ahead of the flight plan time, and it could be refined a little bit in the next 20 minutes.
Rhett Turner will be returning to you for more information from Mission Control. You're listening to the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. Now let's go to the Voice of America newsroom for a summary of late news.
American astronauts Charles Conrad and Alan Bean successfully lifted off the lunar surface after a 31.5-hour stay. They are now undergoing a complex series of maneuvers to rendezvous and dock with the command ship that will carry them back to Earth. The command craft, with astronaut Richard Gordon at the controls, has been orbiting the moon while Commanders Conrad and Bean took two lunar walks, collected moon samples, set up a science station, and retrieved parts of the unmanned Surveyor spacecraft. In Paris, Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge called again for serious negotiations to end the war in Vietnam. He noted that the United States has proposed a mutual withdrawal of forces from South Vietnam within 1 year. He said the United States would be willing to consider any proposal for a mutual withdrawal even sooner. And Ambassador Lodge renewed a long-standing U.S. offer to begin immediate talks on the release of prisoners of war. But the communist side insisted once more on a unilateral U.S. withdrawal and dissolution of the Saigon government. The United States and the Soviet Union held their second session of strategic arms limitation talks in Helsinki. The meeting at the Soviet embassy was described as preliminary and exploratory, with each side seeking a basis for future talks on substantive matters. Radio Vienna says two men, presumably Polish, hijacked a Polish airliner and forced it to land in the Austrian capital. It said the men used a toy pistol and two fake bombs to commandeer the plane. They are being questioned by Vienna police. Reports from Athens say the governments of Greece and Cyprus have called for a continuation of the intercommunal talks on the island of Cyprus. The talks between Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots were indefinitely suspended last month when the chief Turkish Cypriot delegate, Rauf Denktaş, went to London for medical treatment. That's the news in brief. This is Leo Scully reporting on the Voice of America.
From the Apollo News Desk, the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. European reaction to the lunar exploration generally was enthusiastic. Here's a report from VOA's Robert Lodge.
Europeans by the millions were up early before going to work Wednesday to listen to the astronauts working on the moon. In Vienna, headlines about the moonwalk were 5 inches high. The London Times called it a day of triumph. And despite the failure of the television camera on the moon, all of Britain's TV channels went on the air before dawn to describe the second moonwalk by the Apollo 12 astronauts. Radio Bucharest said the moon landing was a perfect success, carried out with such accuracy that the astronauts themselves were amazed. The Geneva newspaper, La Suisse, also was struck by what its headlines called Apollo's fantastic precision. The same words were used by the French paper Combat, which added that this flight is one which is really enabling the astronauts to enter the domain of scientific exploration. This view was echoed in L'Aurore's front-page editorial, in West Germany's Die Welt, and in the Italian Il Popolo. The London Evening Standard said what it proves is that the achievements of the Apollo program are real, that modern science and technology can conquer massive problems in an incredibly short space of time. The paper adds that the need now is for such resources to be directed toward solution of problems here on Earth. In Figaro, French academician Thierry Monnier writes that there is a constant devaluation of miracles, and the day will come when moon trips no longer will make headlines. Scientific progress has produced blasé generations. The Polish Communist Party organ Tribuna Ludu says that even though moon exploration no longer is a solemn and glorious event, it still remains extremely interesting and the most noteworthy event in our very interesting times. In Moscow, news of Apollo 12 appeared again Wednesday in the party organ Pravda at the bottom of an inside page. But the youth newspaper Komsomolskaya Pravda carried an interview with Soviet cosmonaut Konstantin Feoktistov, who's just back from a visit to the United States. He congratulated the U.S. astronauts and wished them all success in their new lunar exploration. Robert Lodge, VOA, European Bureau.
As the Apollo 12 astronauts prepared for their journey back from the moon, rock samples from an earlier moon landing were the subject of some negotiations in Moscow. Sean Kelly reports from the Soviet capital.
Two questions remained unanswered here in Moscow Thursday. This was one of them. Gone. A group of young American schoolchildren ask, as they sang Thursday afternoon at Moscow's now flowerless and nearly frozen Sokolniki Park. They were singing in a school demonstration at the Education USA exhibit now being presented in Moscow as part of the Soviet-American Cultural Exchanges Agreement. The other question being asked here in the Soviet capital concerns some absent moon rocks, or specifically one such sample of lunar landscape now known to be in Moscow. By all appearances, it is scheduled to take a place of honor at the current American exhibit in Sokolniki Park. A special pavilion has been set aside, and a recorded announcement in Russian told visitors Thursday that what they were looking at was a rock brought back from the moon by the Apollo 11 astronauts. The pavilion contained an elaborate chromium and glass case, which on closer inspection revealed itself to be empty. American exhibit officials confirmed that the moon rock had arrived in the Soviet capital and that agreement in principle had been obtained from the Soviet government for it to be shown to the public. There were, however, some final details to be worked out, and the officials said they expected the moon rock to be on view shortly. Meanwhile, the chromium and glass case remains empty, and the moon rock, like the flowers in Sokolniki Park, remains out of sight. This is Sean Kelly, Voice of America, Moscow.
The Museum of Natural History in New York City is now displaying a lunar sample similar to that intended for exhibit at Moscow's Sokolniki Park. Dr. Vincent Manson, the museum's chairman of mineralogy, talked with National Broadcasting Company's Hugh Downs about the lunar samples and compared them to rocks here on Earth.
When one first looks at them, one is surprised at how little difference there seemingly is. It's only on a detailed examination that some of the real unearthly qualities of this material show up.
Unearthly is a good word.
Right. If one turns the specimen, you're sure to see some sparkles of light. And in fact, this is one of the characters which distinguishes this material. This is from a mineral called ilmenite, which acts like a mirror on the surface of this rock, and it's due to the high titanium content. And it's this titanium content in this type of rock which distinguishes it from terrestrial rocks.
Yes. Now, is that something that would deteriorate if it were exposed to the atmosphere of the Earth?
Yes. This sample, of course, has never been in the Earth's atmosphere. It was brought back in the vacuum and then transferred to this container, hermetically sealed in a nitrogen atmosphere.
So there's no oxygen in there?
No oxygen in there at all. But some samples of this material that I've seen that have been exposed to the Earth's atmosphere already show some oxidation, some decomposition. A small amount, but nevertheless, it's not the same.
Is the distribution of elements on the moon, as far as we know, roughly similar to that of Earth, even though the density may be different?
Well, in general, yes, they're quite similar, and I think this is beautiful in that we were able to predict that our knowledge of physics and chemistry extended to the moon and go there and find that this really is the case. It's sort of a nice support of all the scientific knowledge which we've gained over the thousands of years.
What about the origin of the moon, then? What light has been shed on where it came from by having an examination of these rocks?
Well, we don't really have all the answers in yet, but some very interesting results have come out of the preliminary investigation. And, of course, there's hot controversy as regards just what these mean. Yes. The differences in the details in the chemistry show us that the moon has had a slightly different origin. The three main theories, of course, is that the moon either came from the Earth or else that the moon originated along with the Earth, so as to speak, in the same womb, mm-hmm. Close by to the Earth in the solar system, or else it originated somewhere else in the solar system.
Wandered in and was captured.
Right, yes. Yeah.
Now, what's the most likely theory now?
Well, I feel that the chemical evidence we've obtained from samples like this on Apollo 11 make it less likely that it originated on the Earth. Of course, perhaps the most exciting thing about this is that by proxy, it tells us something about the early origins of the Earth.
Of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. This sample is older than anything we have on Earth.
I've seen the figure, 4 billion.
Right. The oldest rock on Earth is 3.6 billion years. And this sample is at least 4.5 billion years.
Then the moon was cool earlier than the Earth.
Well, of course, the Earth...
solid.
And perhaps at the same time. In fact, this lends support to the idea that in the early history of the Earth, it wasn't hot, that it heated up subsequently.
That's a fascinating theory.
So this is something that this sample will help us find out.
Dr. Vincent Manson of New York's Museum of Natural History, some recorded highlights of reaction to the Apollo 12 flight and the space mission. Now, 144 hours and 20 minutes into its mission, with Lunar Module Intrepid going through the maneuvers that will eventually take it to docking with the mothership Yankee Clipper. Bill Land, how about some specifics and a status report?
Well, Norman, right now, Pete Conrad and Al Bean are preparing the lunar module for its next maneuver, which will be the terminal phase initiate, about 20 minutes from now. About 20 minutes ago, they conducted the final circularization maneuver, which made their orbit completely circular and concentric with that of the command module with Dick Gordon in it. And as I mentioned, in about 20 minutes, they'll be conducting their terminal phase initiation, which will start the two spacecraft in a closing situation such that the LEM will increase in altitude above the moon and close in on the command module, and that will be followed by the docking maneuver.
And William McCrory, who covered the EVA-2, is back with us, and I'm sure he's had time for some reflections on the flight of Apollo 12. Welcome back to the anchor desk, Bill.
Well, thanks, Norm. I'm afraid I don't know whether I've had time for reflection, largely trying to catch up with sleep. But I did catch that wonderful takeoff, the ascent from the surface of the moon. Now into what we call orbital mechanics, a rather complicated affair, bringing the Intrepid back up to the mothership for that rendezvous and docking, which will be taking place in another hour or so.
And I believe Rhett Turner is at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, so let's have him join the conversation.
Nick has been able to find us in the sextant.
That's Pete.
And the first night side passed, we had little bits and pieces floating along with us, and we could tell that the tracking light was flashing on them. And we still have, I presume, the same bits and pieces floating along and nothing flashing on them, so I'm pretty sure it burned out.
Roger, Pete.
Pete thinks the tracking light is burned out there on, I believe, on his spacecraft.
TPI has performed over the backside of the moon or the far side pass.
We just had
This is Houston. How'd your sweep down fore and aft go?
How well did he clean up the interior?
It's much cleaner in here running this way. And also, Yankee Clipper informs me as the television all set up, when we come around the horn, we'll come around with the television on in box.
Roger.
We're going to see them as they appear on the other side of the moon with the TV and Yankee Clipper operating.
Who knows? You may get to see the first whippergill.
Roger, Pete. Our electrical watchers say that the current indicates that your tracking light is on.
Intrepid's tracking light is on, according to what is
okay,
visible below.
Okay, now we just turned it off. Now, does the current show that?
They have 4 minutes until we lose
them. It sure does, Pete.
We got an update on when TPI should go. Yankee Clipper can't see it. He says you must be flying backwards.
My ball tells me I'm pointed at you, Dick, and so does my radar.
The radar says he's pointed in the right direction.
Well, you may have current, but you don't have any light.
We've had quite a bit of interesting conversation in the last few minutes. Also, the Earth has now passed up the Earth's tracking solution for the TPI burn. That is recommended, and Pete can select which of these burn solutions he wants to use. He probably will use his onboard. He has up to now on most of his maneuvers.
I'm pretty sure it's burned out. I don't see it flashing anywhere in the spacecraft. Not that I remember seeing it before, but I did remember it on bits and pieces, and I don't see it anymore.
The two spacecraft are 130 kilometers apart, coming together at a rate of 150 kilometers per hour speed, relative speed. The Lunar Module Intrepid is below and behind and will begin to catch up now.
When's LOS, Houston?
We got LOS coming up for both of you in 3 minutes.
3 minutes to loss of signal as they go behind the moon.
Okay, very good.
You're only about 10 seconds apart.
When they appear on the other side of the moon, the TV should be on. The voice-actuated circuit on Intrepid should be operating on the Vox mode. And as Pete says, who knows, you may see the first whiffer-dill there as we come into view.
Apollo Control, Houston, 144 hours, 25 minutes. We presently show Intrepid and Yankee Clipper 53 nautical miles apart with a rate of closure of 136 feet per second. We've got some 2 minutes and roughly 2.5 minutes before we have loss of signal on both vehicles.
They're now closing
at 144 hours, 26 minutes now into the flight. And this is Apollo Control, Houston.
They're now closing at a rate of about 140 kilometers per hour, and they're about 90 kilometers apart. We will lose contact with them in 2 more minutes. Standing by for any conversation, which we do hear before they go over the hill.
Okay, I got a recycle going.
Recycling? That sounded like Al Bean. Both the Intrepid spacecraft and Yankee Clipper have come up with solutions calculated for the TPI maneuver. The Earth has spent about the last hour refining their tracking information. Sounds like we lost a signal there, but it's a little early for that. Maybe one of the communications transmitters went out or just lost lock of the antenna, more likely. The Earth came up with its solution after refined tracking data. It takes about half an hour for these tracking, these very precision bits of tracking information to be refined and for a solution to be brought forth in the trench by the flight dynamics officer. Boy, quite a bit of noise coming from up in the vicinity of the moon. Possibly you can hear just a bit of that. It would be difficult to hear their voices if they should say anything over that noise. We'll keep it turned down low. 36 seconds now until loss of signal. We heard Dick Gordon say, "Okay, Pete, thank you," through the din there. 25 seconds until loss of signal.
Low bit rate, pass that word on to the LEM.
Go low bit rate. Yankee Clipper has been and Intrepid have been ordered to go to low data bit transmission rate as they're about to disappear from us. 11 seconds now until we lose the lunar module. 19 seconds until the command module disappears from view. We should be losing the lunar module right now. Command module any moment now, any second now. We'll get confirmation from mission control of that. And then they will be in the dark for about half an hour. I believe that the noise has ceased on our monitoring line. That does not mean that the signal has been restored. So, the lunar module and the command module, 90 kilometers apart, moving together at this point at a speed of about 140 kilometers per hour, have gone behind
them. Control Houston at 144 hours, 28 minutes into the flight of Apollo 12. We've had loss of signal with both Intrepid and the Yankee Clipper.
They will be on the backside of the moon when we have terminal phase initiation, which should be coming in roughly about 7 minutes from now.
And we'll report more from Houston later.
This is the Voice of America, broadcasting throughout the world with live coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. Today, the ascent from the moon, the rendezvous and docking of the lunar lander Intrepid with the mothership Yankee Clipper. We're moving now rapidly toward what we call TPI, the terminal phase initiation, the firing once again of the thrusters aboard the LEM, placing the ship ever closer to the orbit of the mothership, now some 100 kilometers above the lunar surface, in a near-circular orbit. Bill Lyand, after the firing of the TPI maneuver, this should put the spacecraft on an orbit of about 111 by 79 kilometers, putting it still somewhat below the spacecraft, will it not?
Well, when they conduct this reaction control system burn at terminal phase initiation, actually what it does, it causes the two spacecraft to be on a collision course. The lunar module will increase its apogee, and at the time it crosses the path of the command module, it should be at the exact position of the command module. It's an intersecting type of course. Yes, the orbit, if they were to remain in that orbit and perform no further corrections, would go on up in a higher apogee than the command module. But in fact, prior to arriving at that point of intersection of the two orbits, the lunar module will begin a series of braking maneuvers which will slow it down and put it in the precise orbit in which the command module is in.
Well, Dick Gordon, up in the command module, will not normally should not have to make any maneuvers, should he?
Well, he shouldn't be required to make any maneuvers until the actual docking.
Yes.
Now, after they rendezvous, and rendezvous is considered complete when the two are in the same orbit and station-keeping on one another or remaining close together, then the command module will become active, and Dick Gordon will bring the two together for the docking maneuver.
In other words, the command module will actually do the docking, firing the thrusters if need be, bringing the two craft together. And the LEM will be inactive?
That's right. Well, inactive may not be the exact word, because
no.
It'll be maintaining attitude control to make the job easier for Dick Gordon to maneuver in and dock with him. But as we mentioned, the lunar module does all the maneuvering up to that point, up to the point when they're just a few meters away. And then the command module, because he has better visibility, he's looking straight out his windows at the lunar module, and he can very easily detect and see the position of the docking target on the lunar module. He can maneuver in much more easily than can the two astronauts in the lunar module, because in order for them to see the command module, they have to look out windows which are up above their heads, and consequently they're looking up above their heads and using controls that are directly in front of them, and it's a rather difficult situation. If you could imagine driving a car lying down on your stomach, I think you could see the problem that he would have.
This whole business of orbital mechanics, this matter of rendezvous and docking, perhaps seems oversimple to our listeners. The liftoff from the moon would lead one to believe that you just shoot right up and dock on a, well, almost a straight route to dock with the mother spacecraft. But it's not that at all. It's a very complicated series of orbits, changing the orbital pattern over a period of about 3.5 hours. Now, I've oversimplified, Bill.
Well, I don't know whether you did or whether you made it more complex, as a matter of fact, because while it sounds like a complex series of maneuvers, really they are simplified, and the reason they're simplified is to reduce the amount of energy that's required to conduct the rendezvous. Now, there are many ways that this could be done. There's a brute force way. You could just take off from the lunar surface and just, with all kinds of energy available, you could push yourself right up into the same orbit that the command module is in and conduct one final braking maneuver and settle right out in the orbit that he's in. But this would require a great deal of energy to do it that way. So we've done it in a way that puts them in the easiest orbit we can get into to start out with, and then slowly by a series of touch-ups to that orbit, circularizing, and allowing the two spacecraft or the lunar module to catch up with the command module in that smaller orbit, then the other maneuvers that tweak up that orbit, as we call it, just refine it slightly to make it exactly circular, and then a final maneuver to cause it to intersect with the orbit that the command module is in, and then finally the braking maneuvers. I don't know whether I explained that too well, but the point is that we do these things so that we take advantage of the energy that's available and the mechanics associated with the speed that you have to attain to be in orbit and the relative speeds of the two vehicles in different orbits.
Well, Bill, one further question on this. Throughout this period, we're trying to catch up, actually, with the mother ship. Why is the braking maneuver needed there at the last, just before we have rendezvous and docking?
Well, they'll start this terminal phase in an orbit that is smaller than the orbit of the command module. To catch up with the command module and to get in a position adjacent to it, they have to increase their speed, and this increases the size of their orbit, and it really increases it to an elliptical orbit that is larger than the orbit in which the command module is in.
Mm-hmm.
So that when they intersect or when they get close to the command module, they have to take some energy back out of that orbit in order to circularize and go into the same orbit that the command module is in. So there is why the braking maneuvers are necessary. If they didn't do that, they would continue to rise to a higher altitude than the command module.
We should have terminal phase initiation right now. Rhett Turner, you're standing by in Houston. You have the clocks there.
We had two calculations. Pete's onboard calculations was 144 hours, 34 minutes, 55 seconds, which was a minute ago. And the ground, the numbers that Jerry Carr passed up were 144 hours, 35 minutes, and 52 seconds. There was a one-minute discrepancy in the reports, but that didn't seem to faze anybody. And we assume Pete used his onboard figures and that he has performed TPI, terminal phase initiate, to move the orbit of his spacecraft up right along with, and as Bill says, on a sort of collision course, up with the command module Yankee Clipper. They were to burn the thrusters for 22 seconds and add about 24 and a half feet per second, some 30 miles an hour, to the speed. And the rendezvous radar is constantly working. When they began this maneuver, they were about 90 kilometers apart and moving at 140 kilometers per hour toward each other in their relative closing speeds. That's it. They're still out of touch behind the moon, acquisition of signal. They should come around the other side of the moon with live TV on and voices babbling away in 36 minutes.
Well, Rhett Turner, just before we lost signal, we weren't hearing a great deal from Pete Conrad and Alan Bean, and quite frankly, I'm accustomed to hearing a great deal from them, particularly after that last moonwalk of some 3 hours and 55 minutes. You suppose they're tired or just quite busy?
Not at all. This has been a long day for them. They have been enjoying themselves immensely. I know they're keyed up. They're busy. There's quite a bit of activity. There are so many things to be done at this point. They are keyed up and going at it. And this is procedure which is requires their own concentration, and it's not one in which there are moments for the very ebullient outgoing comments they've been making, and I'm sure there's no reason for us not hearing from them other than the fact that they were busy. Walter Sullivan, the science editor of the New York Times, commented on the EVA period just hours ago that they certainly seem to be having the time of their lives. And all of the reporters and correspondents gathering around in our newsroom down here have been commenting upon this outgoing crew and how vocal they were, trying to share everything that they're experiencing with us and with Mission Control. It makes Mission Control's job much easier.
It does indeed. And one final question before I leave you for the moment, Rhett. We're accustomed to having at least a song from Pete Conrad. Have we had any humming today?
We've had the tum-tum-tum-tums on the surface. We haven't had much of that since they've been back inside. No, they've been busy. There was one little comment. I heard one little vocal comment and a few laughs as something funny happened. But that's about it. They have been busy.
A highly articulate crew, even though they're extremely busy.
Vocal, anyway.
Indeed.
Some people say noisy, but we agree with just vocal.
The Voice of America, broadcasting throughout the world with live coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. The lunar module, Intrepid, now moving ever closer to the mothership, Yankee Clipper, for that rendezvous and docking. That should come about